This is The Root Cellar on Pioneer 90.1, where regional history and family folklore come together with your hosts, Jim and Jan Stramley.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're now ready for the next act. Well, does that sound familiar? Have you been to the circus lately? Jan and I took our little second-grade granddaughter in St. Paul to the Shrine Circus recently. It hasn't changed much. There are the three rings, the clowns, the performers on high trapezes, the fog machine, the animals, and the jugglers. But my curiosity was aroused as to why and how all this came about. In other words, what are the roots of the circus? Well, that's what this episode of Root Cellar is about. Another reason why my curiosity was aroused is because I'm reading a book entitled Water for Elephants, which is about life in the circus. There is much more to the circus than what you see under the big top. The interactions of all the people involved, the relationships, and the problems that they face bringing the circus to the rubes, that's circus lingo for customers, and people attending the circus were sometimes referred to as suckers. That's more circus lingo. The goal is to get as much money out of each and every person who attends. At the circus that we were at, they had people selling food, candy, popcorn, toys for kids that light up in the dark, and much more. I know, I realize in this instance, some of the profit goes to the Shriners to help with their charitable endeavors. And we may do a Root Cellar on them one day. Well, I researched the history of the circus on the internet, and this is what I found. When it comes to the past history, you should know that the start of this enterprising business did not begin with Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. No, siree. The concept originated during the time of ancient Rome. You remember the chariot races and the battle between man and some form of wildlife? Maybe lions or tigers? These performances paved the way for the types of shows we are privileged to enjoy today. In those past times, the typical circus was held within an oval with tiered seatings on all sides, and trained exotic animals wowed the crowds while jugglers and acrobats amused guests prior to the next battle or race. People of rank were seated in the lower levels, and the hosts were often seated in suites with their friends. In ancient Rome, the circus was significant in history because it was the only public scene that allowed men and women to enjoy an event together. After the fall of Rome, Europe had no defined circus for people to attend. Wandering showmen traveled around the continent, but the allure of the original Roman circus was lost for the time being. The circus may have been kept alive for the modern world to enjoy by a group of gypsies who traveled around in Europe during the Middle Ages, bringing circus skills and trained animals for entertainment. Even then, the object was money, however they were able to obtain it. Later in the 18th century, the circus concept of acrobats and horses and other performances became quite popular. As to the father of the modern circus, many credit a Briton named Philip Astley, who had the first permanent and traveling circus in England. The circus became so popular in that country that large cities constructed buildings for the purpose of accommodating the circus. In 1825, Joshua Purdy Brown became the first circus owner to utilize a large canvas tent for circus performances. America followed the path of England and established reputable shows for the public. There was P.T. Barnum, who started in the business with a freak show and the sideshow approach. American William Cameron Coop also revolutionized the concept of the circus within the United States. Coop became the first circus entrepreneur to commission the use of circus trains, which transported shows from town to town. This is the concept that they used in the book I am reading. Coop also introduced the multiple ring approach, which allowed more than one attraction to occur at a time. Well, circus performances started to flourish all over the world, and Russia was actually the first to offer a class at a state university in circus arts. Well, this brought performances to a new professional level, and because of the impressive performers, better pay and conditions paved the way for the contemporary circuses of today. In the 1960s and 1970s, it brought harsh times for the circus as animal rights became a hot topic of concern. Circuses started using more human performers and less animal acts in order to maintain their business. There were still some animal acts in the circus we attended, but nothing that was cruel or harmful to the animal. They had a couple of elephants that would do tricks, stand on their heads, lift their feet, and roll over, and they seemed to enjoy it. They also sold tickets during intermission to a long line of people to ride the elephants, another way to get more money from the suckers. An illustrious example of an animal-free circus show now is the infamous Cirque du Soleil productions, which have transformed the circus into something more professional without the animal acts. And guess what? The whole idea is still to make tons of money. In my research, I found classes available now in Las Vegas for trapeze artists training, and in Florida for juggling and other similar acts. And I know they have clown schools in some parts of the country for that purpose as well. The circus we attended still had the traditional circus flavor, although it was held in the Horse Coliseum at the state fairgrounds. Our granddaughter was looking for the tent. They had a ringmaster or circus MC who would introduce the acts, first blowing on his whistle, and he would speak to the audience and just keep the show moving along. We also saw the lion tamer act, but thank goodness he did not place his head in the lion's mouth. There were many trapeze artists with no nets, of course, and besides all their antics high above the ground, they would spin around hanging only by a strap attached to their teeth. The circus ended with a daredevil act with a couple of fellows on motorbikes spinning around in a small, round wire enclosure. How they were able to avoid a collision was remarkable. But isn't that what the circus is all about? To keep you on the edge of your seat? Now here is Jan with an interview.
Well, sorry, Jim, this isn't going to be an interview as planned. Since Jim is talking about the history of the circus, I thought it would be fun to find out some history about the Pennington County Fair. And I was able to get my hands on this wonderful little book that was published for the Centennial Fair in 2001. And according to the fair board members now, most of the credit for this history book can be given to Norma Hansen from Goodrich, who was on the fair board at that time. And this publication was compiled by Donna Meyer in the interest of the fair board. And I have been assured that the book will find a place in the public library. If you're interested in reading more details and history of the Pennington County Fair, I can assure you it's interesting. I will just pull out some excerpts. It was 1902 when the first idea of a fair came into being in this area. And of course, at that time, it was not Pennington County, but we were part of Red Lake County. So a space of 20 acres of land was leased from C.J. Knox for the purpose of setting up a fairgrounds. Shares were sold for $25 each, and within a week, $1,200 was raised to add to the $450 from state aid to county fairs and the city's donation of $500, and they were on the way. A racetrack was built for the new fairgrounds, and nearly 2,000 people attended that first two-day affair. The next year, in 1903, the fair featured two balloon ascensions and parachute jumps by Professor Hoffman of the T.I. Cash Shows. Acrobats, bicycle riders, and champion high diver of the world, Charles Strahl, making two 75-foot dives into a life-saving net. In actual practice, according to the newspaper, Charlie Strahl's net wasn't tight enough the first day, and he hit the ground with his shoulders hard enough to drive all the wind out of him. But the next day, Hoffman's balloon didn't lower as it should, and it drifted down to a Roxbury farm a few miles away, where the farmer got it and hid it in a load of hay. Hoffman went after it and got it back just in time to do his act on the third day with an ascension of 2,000 feet, and the balloon and its parachuting operator landing in the horseshoe south of the mill pond, where Hugo's supermarket stands today. That year, a special train from Crookston brought people to celebrate the fair for a day. And Fred Roulette was responsible for securing a large group of Indians for the fair. They camped on the fairgrounds and had a special tent for performing various native dances. The news reported one unfortunate circumstance, however, that although the fair management said that nothing stronger than a 10-cent game would be allowed on the grounds, a number of graft games moved in by the afternoon of the second day and fleeced quite a few poor suckers, and that I quote. So we're still talking about suckers in light of fairs and circuses, aren't we? In 1907, the Red Lake County Fair included a Roman hippodrome race and a large troop of Indian maidens to dance for the public. Special trains that year were secured on both the Sioux and the Great Northern tracks to bring in crowds from nearby towns. And also, a steamboat ran special excursions from points up the Red Lake River to Thief River Falls to see the Red Lake County Fair. The TI Cash Carnival, with 80 employees, again furnished the midway, and horse racing brought in contestants from Winnipeg, Grand Forks, and Fargo. That year, the paper announced that Thursday was the biggest day, with about 5,000 people attending that day. However, numerous pickpockets and other robberies were reported in such locations as the Northern Hotel, the train depot, private homes, and the Klimek jewelry store. In 1909, the Chicago Amusement Company managed the midway and featured a man and an African lion both ascending in a balloon and each parachuting to earth in separate parachutes. A bronco breaking contest offered a first prize of $10, as well as foot races and novelty horse races, in addition to the regular horse racing. The news stated that the exhibits were by far better this year than ever before. The agricultural building was filled with the best display of grains, grasses, vegetables, etc., ever collected together in northern Minnesota, and it opened the eyes of all visitors. The women's building was also filled with exhibits, and they were very neatly arranged. The exhibit of stock and poultry was exceptionally fine and in number was far greater than ever before seen at a former fair. In 1911, Pennington County had been born, and so this was the first year of it being called the Pennington County Fair. The officers of that fair association had made arrangements with the Webster Amusement Company of Fargo to furnish a flying machine and an aeronaut for the 3 days of the fair. There were six flights, two every day. The aeroplane will also be on exhibit at the fairgrounds for closer inspection. And this was a real novelty. In 1912, the Thief River Falls baseball team, called the Indians, played a series of games against Roseau and Warren and won several of them. The fairgrounds, located a couple of blocks east of where St. Bernard's Cemetery is now, was the scene. But in March of 1913, this changed, and the fair board decided to purchase a 25-acre lot at the west end of 4th Street, and that's where the fair is held yet to this day. In 1914, the city council arranged for the fairgrounds to be provided with electric lights and ordered that all carnival activities be confined to the fairgrounds rather than partially downtown. At this fair, the famous aviator Lincoln Beachy provided daredevil upside-down flying in two shows per day. Monday night, revolver shots and a spirited knife fight between several carnival men caused the local police to warn 8 people, 6 men and 2 women, to leave the city. In 1918, Company C of the Minnesota Home Guard sponsored a fair dance at the city auditorium to raise money for the war. As a fundraiser for the Red Cross, a series of children's Shetland pony races was organized using mainly 6 ponies owned by Fred Bierbauer. A canning demonstration showed the best ways to preserve foods without using sugar, as sugar was rationed. An interesting feature of the 1919 and 1920 Pennington County Fairs was that for this brief two-period time in local history, there were 2 county fairs, the regular one in Thief River Falls and a tri-county fair which took place in Goodridge. The 1922 Pennington County Fair featured a mock battle on the final day of the activities, complete with machine guns, trenches, barbed wire entanglements, bombs, and a barrage by rifle grenadiers, and later a demonstration of Red Cross stretcher bearers, all supplied by the Elmer J. Eklund Post of the American Legion. Wow, what an undertaking that must have been. The 1928 fair featured a tug of war, and arrangements were made for a commercial 8-passenger airplane to fly in and out of the Noper pasture to provide fair patrons with a sightseeing trip over the city. Over 200 local children were enrolled in 4-H by this time, bringing their exhibits to the fair. And I'm going to close this segment of the very early history of the Pennington County Fair with this. In 1932, over 2,500 people, the largest grandstand crowd in the history of the fair, watched the public wedding of Natalie Wolson and Frank P. Johnson. It was a feature attraction of that 1932 Pennington County Fair. Norwegian Lutheran pastor Reverend Tungsten, the mayor of Thief River Falls, officiated. What an exciting event to have happen at the fair. And maybe another time we can go into a little bit more of the later history and then possibly an interview. It's all part of the history of our Pennington County. And that's all for today. Bye.